uploading the virus.
Eagle One, the package is being delivered.
Hello out there on the internet. I am Matthew Galt, and this is Cyber. A terrible April Fool's Day glitch screws over Uber drivers. Tenants in California are striking back against landlords and private banks. Do we need them? Today's episode of Cyber is a cipher, that infrequent version of the show where we decipher some recent tech news. It's a potpourri for the panopticon age, a grab bag of tech horrors, a not-so-gentle reminder that our work is not yet done. With me today is Motherboard reporter Roshan Abraham. Sir, thank you so much for coming onto the show and walking us through some of this.
Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. So the tease up at the beginning of the show, the first thing I wanted to talk about was this April Fool's Day Uber glitch. So what happened to Uber drivers around April 1st?
So basically a bunch of Uber Eats drivers. We don't know exactly how many, but it seems like it was probably like in the thousands. Some people said it was everyone they know. And Uber didn't really tell us exactly how many people, but basically all these folks got a message on April 1st saying that Uber had accidentally overpaid their base rate the previous day, and now they were going to be subtracting that overpayment from their account immediately. And so people basically got, you know, these deductions, like immediate deductions in their account on April 1st, like very bad timing. I mean, there's probably no good time to do that. But yeah, so, you know, what Uber has, what Uber told us is that this was, you know, everyone got paid, overpaid, like they got double pay basically the day before on their base rate that they accepted in the app when they like took on their gig that day. And where I heard lots of different stories from people who reached out to me, but there's some dispute among drivers whether that is accurate. Some people are saying, no, you just like across the board just sort of took off. You just like made these deductions even to people you didn't overpay. So I think that aspect of it is something that's still kind of like
in dispute.
In dispute. And we still need to figure out exactly what happened there. But what Uber is saying is like they just made a glitch error and overpaid their base pay.
Yeah, we've got some, obviously, Uber drivers talk to each other online. So you had pulled from Reddit a bunch of people posting kind of their screenshots of what had been taken from them. $94.39 adjustment here, overpayment for trips between the 31st and April 2nd. An incorrect overpayment was made to your account, same date range. We will adjust -$75.86 paid or payable to you for the affected trip. And was this all Uber Eats drivers? As far as you can tell, nobody that was like taking somebody around a city was doing this happened to?
Yeah, I've only heard about it from Uber Eats drivers. Like, as far as I know, there wasn't like non-food delivery Uber drivers haven't en masse said anything about this. So for some reason, whatever happened seems to have been concentrated with Uber Eats drivers.
And we don't have any idea why this happened or what the nature of the glitch was, right?
No, the Uber didn't really tell us what happened. They said they regret the error. You know, all they said was that it was a double payment. You know, whether it was some technical glitch, whether it was like a manual issue, that, you know, we just like don't know right now.
Somebody was able to get their, one of these Uber drivers was able to get their money back, right? Like they complained to Uber and fought and Uber backed off.
Well, someone on Reddit did say that. I don't know that person got their money back. I mean, like a lot of people reached out to me and some people had documentation of, you know, screenshots and stuff. But like from the screenshots and stuff that I got, You know, none of the folks who said that Uber gave them the money back reached out to me with documentation, or if I reached out to them, I didn't hear from them. I don't know for sure if that happened, but the conversation on Reddit is some folks are saying they did.
So this is another data point in a bunch of data points that is essentially it is precarious and shitty to be a gig worker, especially for one of these Uber and or one of these other companies that's like a food delivery service, right? Like this is all, it's not a good place to work as far as we can tell, right?
Yeah, I think the consensus is it's not a great place to work. Yeah, but I would say I think like five people who emailed me said, I'm not going to work here anymore. I'm sick of this. I think the biggest complaint, more so than the money, and some people, you know, they still think that Uber pays well compared to like DoorDash and some other similar food delivery folks. But I think the main complaint is like Uber's very opaque in terms of how it explains certain things to its drivers. You know, when they sent that message to all their drivers and said, you know, there was an error, there was an overpayment, like it wasn't really itemized. They didn't say here were the specific rides and here's how much you got paid and here's what we were deducting. They didn't even really explain, like when they gave us the comment, we almost got more information than they gave to their drivers, you know, and we didn't really get much information from them other than, you know, they said it was a double payment, but like they didn't really do any kind of accounting or math or attempt to go into any detail about what the overpayment was or anything like that when they contacted their drivers. So I think it's another issue with just like the overall opacity and bad communication with drivers. It's I think one of the studies we linked to is people feel like it's like gambling working for their apps, which is totally understandable.
Right. I'm going to read the statement here. I've got it pulled up. For several hours on March 31st, Uber experienced a technical issue that resulted in couriers being paid double the fare shown for each delivery trip. In all cases, couriers were paid the full amount they were shown before accepting a trip. We apologize for the error and are working to prevent this from happening again. Which, as you said, we go back and we look at what the drivers were posting on Reddit and what they had told you that they had experienced. Due to a technical issue, you received duplicate earnings for this day, and then they just took the money. Yeah. So it's significantly more when talking to a journalist, which is honestly a little bit more than we often get out of some of these tech companies, right?
Yeah. And I think the other thing worth mentioning is like they took the money out of Uber's app, you know, like they couldn't take it out of their like bank account or something. So they took it out of the Uber app. And I think some folks, either they had already kind of moved the money to their account or something like that, but you know, folks have bills to pay. And for some folks that resulted in them having like negative dollars in their account. And that kind of, puts them in a weird position where some of them had to like end up borrowing money in order to like do their trips for the day. So I think even if you take Uber's, even if Uber's 100% correct that this was a double payment and that was like a total glitch and legally they have every right to take it back, even if that's the case, it really puts drivers in a really difficult position to make such kind of big mistakes and take the money back.
I think this says it all. It's a quote from one of the drivers. If there was a glitch in the system, that's on you all, right? Like,
yeah.
You know, it's not the driver's fault that they were overpaid.
Yeah. And I think that like from the perspective of some of these drivers, it's like, I'm just kind of like paying my bills like, you know, week to week. I'm kind of like struggling out here. And if you overpaid me by like a little bit, like why is it even a big deal? Like maybe just overpay me for once. Like, and some one person said like, well, I drove through a blizzard. So I just assumed that Uber was like, you know,
surge pricing
a little bit extra. Yeah.
Yeah. You know? Yeah, of course.
So
it's almost as if, these food delivery apps, are kind of falling apart for everybody involved, delivery drivers and the people buying the food and perhaps the middlemen themselves.
Yeah. They're not fun. We'll see if, any of these companies are able to start turning a profit, but I imagine as they like increasingly try to like turn a profit, it's not going to be fun for, anyone.
When was the last time you used one, or have you ever used one?
Not the only time, but I generally don't use food delivery because I live in a very food rich area in Jackson Heights and Queens, and like pretty much there's like tons of great food in walking distance, so I generally don't have to. I did like in February, I had COVID and I like just didn't leave my apartment for like a week.
Yeah, I think and you and was, I yeah. I think you and I had COVID around the same time, actually.
Oh wow. Yeah.
Yeah.
Sorry.
It sucks. Yeah. As we both know.
Yeah. But like that was the only time that I was like regularly using these apps. And it's definitely a lifesaver for that. Like I couldn't, you know, I really didn't have energy to like go across the street and go to a grocery store or anything. But yeah, I mean, generally I don't use them that much, but I think if you do use them and you're in a position to tip well, I think that's probably a good strategy.
I would say, and we've talked about this on the show a little bit before, that the prices have risen for the user. The prices have gone up astronomically and the service is getting much worse. I would imagine because of things like this, like drivers getting, you know, squeezed and kind of screwed over in the middle of the process constantly and not being treated well. And I imagine there are users that don't tip. In fact, I know there aren't because we've reported on it. And we've talked to the Uber drivers before. So yeah, I feel very much like this is a, you know, it was great, when I had COVID and I was able to get deliveries, but I don't see this business lasting too much longer, but we'll see. All right, there, cyber listeners, want to pause there for a break. We'll be right back after this.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
All right, cyber listeners, welcome back. All right, let's move on to another one of your stories that I thought was really interesting, especially because I had never heard of such a thing, because I am a Southern man, and they have beaten the ideas of unions out of us so hard that I don't even think that things like this are possible. What is a tenants union?
Well, I mean, tenant unions are, they're just sort of collections of tenants coming together to advocate for conditions in their buildings. And, you know, it could be, they could be citywide, they could be building wide, they could be across the portfolio of a corporate entity that owns a bunch of buildings. And yeah, I mean, like for the most part, a tenant union, it's not like legally recognized in the way that like a labor union would be, with the exception being in San Francisco, where they passed a law requiring landlords to negotiate in good faith with building-wide tenant unions. But yeah, I mean, the tenant union is just like a collective of renters coming together to advocate for improvements of the conditions in the homes where they live, or to sort of like beat back evictions, that kind of thing.
So your story specifically focuses on the Blackstone Tenants Union in San Diego. Real quick, give us the background on Blackstone. This is a group that invests in large amounts of real estate all over the country. Is that correct?
Yeah, Blackstone's like a gigantic private equity firm. I think they manage other people's assets, and they own property. And they're very big. I think that their cash on hand was, I don't know, maybe like $100 billion, I want to say. Let me look through the story. I'm sure it says.
I've got it pulled up here.
Their market cap is $100 billion.
And they manage $975 billion worth of assets across the globe.
Yeah. So they're pretty huge, and they've gotten into trouble all over planet Earth. I think, where was it, like in Scotland and other sort of like European countries where they were found to be exacerbating the housing crisis. Oh, Denmark, Ireland, the Czech Republic, Spain, and Sweden. The UN accused Blackstone of exacerbating the housing crisis by inflating rents across its portfolio. So if like in certain markets, if they own enough housing, they can kind of like manipulate rents by, just sort of like raising rents, and people have less options to go outside of their portfolio. I think their ability to manipulate the rental market is probably a little bit smaller in the United States just because it's so huge. So in the US they own 300,000 units, I believe. So they're technically the largest landlord in the United States. That's still, a relatively small percent of the overall housing stock in the United States, but it's still a lot of housing. So they are, they have
been landlords were kind of in this place during the pandemic where you couldn't evict anybody. And now that has gone away, landlords are letting the good times roll, so to speak, right? We've got in your piece in Georgia, the company filed 170 evictions in last October in Maricopa County, Arizona, everyone's favorite county in Arizona. The company filed 70 evictions in September, and according to the report that you're talking about here, in some cases, Blackstone filed to evict tenants who owed just 1 month's rent. So they're kind of catching up. They're making up for lost time, right?
Yeah, they're making up for lost time. And I mean, what they say is, we had like our eviction moratorium, like we had a voluntary eviction moratorium that actually went longer than the federal eviction moratorium, which is true. Their eviction moratorium was longer than it legally needed to be. They were in some areas kind of lenient. But I think it's important to remember that they, can afford to do that. Like, they're gigantic. So like their margins are not hurt that much. If they, give folks a little bit more time to pay the rent. In the last quarter of 2022, they started to wind down their own voluntary eviction moratorium and started evicting a lot of people. Yeah. And so it's really just about sort of like increasing their profit margins. They have a real estate investment trust. And there was a video leaked to Insider. Nadeem Megji, who's like the head of their real estate division, said, "We're also seeing a meaningful increase in economic occupancy as we move past what were voluntary eviction restrictions that had been in place for the last couple of years." Yeah. So like they're basically, yeah.
They get to jack up rents now, essentially.
Yeah. Yeah. So they're excited about that. He wanted to calm down the investors who are worried that they were evicting enough people.
And then to kind of fight back against this in San Diego, you have this group called the Blackstone Tenants Union, which is formed in 2021. What kind of things can this tenants union do, and what is their fight like right now?
I mean, they can go on rent strikes, and they can just sort of like, you know, advocate as a body. They can just sort of like coordinate actions. They work with a nonprofit. It's just like about solidarity and getting a lot of renters who are in that in their portfolio to sort of like come together and demand better conditions as one entity.
And how's that fight going?
I guess, it's a difficult fight. I think that Blackstone is, they've been really ramping up evictions specifically across their portfolios in San Diego County. And I think with those specific properties, like they're trying to get a really high turnover to like increase the, the overall rents on those units. I think that was like one thing that was shown in that report we looked at was the average rents in like 10 of the buildings that they own in San Diego County, they went up dramatically. And they went up by an amount that like they couldn't legally have gone up if they had the same tenants in the unit. In other words, in California, there is sort of rent control for just like renewing your lease where like you can't raise the rent on a lease renewal by more than 5%. But the average rents had gone up by well above 5%. That just likely points to the fact that the turnover was really high. And if the turnover was really high, it's probably because a lot of people were getting evicted.
This story in the piece really boiled my blood. Woman in San Diego with her family, they'd signed a 12-month lease agreement in August, agreeing to pay $2,192 a month. Then Blackstone takes over the complex where she's living, and they decide they're not going to honor that lease that she's already signed, right? And they're going to jack up the price.
Yeah. That is one thing that happened. So basically she she had signed the lease. When she signed the lease, she went into the office and she lives with her brother and her husband. And she said, "Do I need to sign this lease along with my brother and husband? Can I just sign it just myself?" She was advised, "No, you just need to sign it yourself." She signed the lease and then she says every time she went to the office to pay the rent after Blackstone took over, there was a different person there who was like dealing with her. And like every time she went in, they would sort of be apologetic. And at first they said like, "Oh, we don't have the lease. We don't know where it is." And then she was like, "I have a copy. I'll just make you a copy." And she like went, made a copy, gave it to them, and they apologized and were like, "Oh yeah, we'll fix it." And then they were like, you know, they kept coming up with like little technical things that were wrong with the lease. And like every time she like did what they told her to do. And then finally, you know, I think the most recent and last thing that Blackstone rep told her was, oh yeah, your husband and your brother who are living with you, they didn't sign the lease, so it's like not a valid lease. And I, you know, I didn't have a chance to dig into exactly whether, you know, that makes sense in terms of California's rental law. But you know, it's just it is, you know, pretty disturbing that they just kept kind of coming up with new.
They can just keep changing the rules on you, right?
Just kind of.
And she eventually moved out, and it looks like Blackstone still says that she owes them $10,000.
Yeah. So Blackstone is still fighting her over the $10,000. At some point they stopped taking her rent. Like first it was just, you know, 1 month's rent she owed. And then the office was like, oh, we can only take payments in full. So if you can't just pay 1 month and not pay last month, so we're going to take none of it. And over months that grew to $10,000. And so when we asked, Blackstone, they basically said like, oh, we have a blanket policy, that if, tenants don't, if tenants can't pay rent for 1 month, you know, we think it's better to not accept their rent if they can't pay in full. So they have money to move somewhere else. That's essentially what their narrative was.
How kind of them.
Which doesn't really make sense because they're still pursuing $10,000 in back rent. So yeah.
Good.
There you go.
Good and cool. Let's make a connection to another story that you wrote about another study. The headline is, "Want to curb city crime? Evict fewer tenants, study says." So what is this study? I believe it was, there's several new studies actually. What is kind of what's going on here?
Yeah, this study is out of Cornell, University, and this one's more recent, came out like this month. There've also been studies in Ohio, Pennsylvania, Boston. Those are older studies. Some of them are a few years old. And the study out of New York, it basically, I think, builds on the older studies, which show a clearer causal connection between evictions and certain types of crimes. But what the New York study basically looks at is two factors called social cohesion and economic connectedness. Which I guess sociologists have clearly tied those two phenomena to decreases in crime when those two things are, you know, when those two things increase in a city. So the New York report looks at those two factors, social cohesion, economic connectedness, and shows that they decrease in upstate cities in New York State, where evictions have been taking place. But it doesn't draw a direct causal connection to crimes necessarily.
Right.
But it basically says, you know, well, we can infer because of those two, you know, those two sort of like data points that crime would probably increase because it's been proven that crime increases when those two factors decrease.
How does somebody measure social cohesion?
Well, this part was a little interesting. So like they pulled the data from something called Social Atlas, which I guess is a website that it basically just trawls Facebook, like Facebook friendships and connections and interactions and likes, I guess, looks at that and can come up with measures of social connectedness and economic connectedness for different geographic areas. I wasn't familiar with this beforehand. The researcher behind the report said, what did he say there? It's highly consistent with the growing state of knowledge on evictions, community impacts. The Facebook data, the measures are far from perfect, but that atlas has been one of the higher profile, finer spatial resolution attempts to measure various dimensions of social capital across the US. It's basically pulling from Facebook data to come up with these measurements. Not perfect, but I think that looking at some of the data from other cities is also interesting, and I think adds some context.
Right. New York's not a monolith, or it's not representative of the entire country. But it does seem like there is something going on in most American cities that is connected to all of this stuff. Rents are getting higher. It's harder for people to hold on to what they have. There's a houselessness crisis, right? And it's especially bad in places like Los Angeles, where you wrote about what the mayor's new proactive program is. Can you tell me about that?
Yeah. Basically the new mayor, Karen Bass, came in and, she ran on, one of the big, if not the biggest issues she ran on was homelessness. And, she had a very big, very ambitious, set of policies to, address homelessness. And, I think to her credit is very ambitious and is very serious about the issue. I think that it's still, some of her policies are kind of new and they're still kind of shaking out, but there were a lot of questions as to whether she would, continue some of the negative approaches of her predecessor.
What are those negative approaches?
Yeah. So, Garcetti, who's the previous mayor, in terms of outdoor homelessness, unsheltered homelessness, he's very, I guess, very, not shy about using police. And there were some really high profile, very negative incidents, particularly around the Echo Lake encampment, where a bunch of people were arrested. I believe some journalists were arrested. In the end, the vast majority of those people just kind of got pushed around and didn't end up in any kind of permanent housing. I think there's been a real tension with a lot of mayors across the country who get tons of flack from their housed constituents complaining about encampments for, being eyesores, unsightly, in their belief of increasing crime. And sometimes there are, pockets of open air drug use and that kind of thing. So there's been tension between that and using this very blunt and I think ineffective strategy of getting police to come in and move people when there's nowhere for them to go.
Right. And kind of just move them to another location where they have kind of set up a different style of encampment, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Because if you're not giving people kind of long-term places to live, you're all you're doing is kind of moving the issue around. And it's, I mean, you know, I think when mayors kind of feel like they have their hand tied for whatever reason to address homelessness, they're like very eager to just throw the police out there just for the short term political gain of being able to tell their voters that they did something, even if that thing is not helpful at all.
I did something. Here are the pictures of me doing something.
Yeah. But back to Karen Bass, I think, yeah, so she wanted to take, you know, a softer touch, but didn't give like a whole lot of details. And I think, you know, her whole comprehensive plan is a little bit more, you know, there are some really good things in there. Like she wants to like find more like city owned land and build permanent housing and, you know, kind of like get through kind of bureaucratic red tape and like all that stuff, which is good. But in terms of encampments, her plan was, you know, she called it, I think either
inside safe.
Yeah. So like, and these plans, like they always have some kind of name like that. That's kind of like very gentle and very compassionate sounding. So like, I don't think the name was going to like communicate necessarily what the policy was. But yeah, so it's called Inside Safe. She was kind of cagey about whether it would involve police. I think she said at a press conference, well, you know, they're going to be there if we need to have them there, but like, this isn't about policing. And so, you know, I think in practice there've been, kind of a few issues with the program. I think the overarching thing is like, she, like the program, it moves, it's like, she's doing it maybe probably a little bit too quickly and hasn't prepared what she has, promised, which yeah. which is that, you know, what she said was like, okay, we're going to go to people on the street and we're going to offer them, you know, hotel stays, single room hotel stays. Well, actually, I don't think she said single room, but we're going to offer them hotel stays and they will be able to stay in that hotel, for either up to a year or up to 2 years. And then we will transition them to permanent housing. And people were really skeptical of this, because it like sounds nice to a lot of people, but it's like, how are you going to follow through? Is this actually what's going to happen? And so I think in practice, you know, the problem was that A, the hotel rooms weren't all secured. And then, you know, people were being shuffled around between hotel rooms. People were in a hotel room for a week. Then they got moved to a different hotel room that had like way more strict rules, way more carceral. And there were some folks, rewinding my thoughts here. There were some folks who were, yeah, there was concerns about police. As I said, you know, she'd kind of downplayed police, but didn't make it clear if, she was going to use police. But what folks told me is like, no, there's police at, almost all of, these, Inside Safe operations. You know, they're not jumping out and handcuffing everybody. And I think that, Mayor Bass has touted zero arrests, which as far as I know is correct. There haven't been any arrests in any of these actions, but like, you know, it's Department of Sanitation going out and basically like taking people's property and, you know, clearing up these encampments, and they can call the police at any point. Sometimes they go with the police. Sometimes the police are nearby and they'll just see, you know, interact with someone who may be having a mental health crisis and they don't know how to handle it. Then they call in the police. So the police, if they're not there immediately, it seems like they do usually show up.
Right.
And I've been told at one encampment in particular in Venice that the police were just there very consistently and that they like keep coming back.
I need to apologize to Beatmaster 80 in the chat and everyone who's listening right now for blasting them with Windows notification noises as I was looking for specific things to quote from your story. So apologies. I'll endeavor to make that stop. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I'm sorry to Beatmaster 80.
All right, one more story before we let you go and we wrap up. So Silicon Valley Bank, Signature Bank, we've had some high-profile bank failures recently. You wrote a piece about it at the time, kind of rethinking. I'm sorry, chat is cracking me up. I've listened to Cyber for years and always laugh when those notification sounds happen. Haha. Listen, okay, I'm going to mute them next time. I'm sorry. Anyway, high-profile bank failures, which caused you to write this piece kind of rethinking the way we think about banking entirely. The title is Private Banks Are in Crisis. What if they were public banks? What would be the difference between a private and public bank? And isn't it just a credit union?
I think the difference between like a credit union and a public bank is like a, you know, the idea of a public bank is like they're a place where government funds are deposited and that like a certain amount of government funds and investments have to be deposited there. And then there is a board that determines how that money is then invested. And I think that credit unions are more for like personal loans and lending, whereas public banks, as far as I know, they're like not really designed for individualized lending. I think that the idea of a public bank is just like a way to manage government assets in a way that doesn't rely on private banks.
Questions from the chat. When the nation bails them out, they kind of already are public banks. No, it's kind of an interesting question, right? Like people want the private risk and private reward, or I guess they want to turn private risk into public risk when something goes wrong. Right. And I think that's kind of been the story since 2008. Yeah.
Yeah. I think the public bank movement, which I think really blossomed after 2008 and has kind of been growing since then and really has been growing more since the pandemic, is sort of rooted in that idea of like, well, if we're bailing out and subsidizing private banks, why do we have no control over how they operate? And wouldn't it be better if we had banks with more democratic controls in terms of how they operate? So I think that while a public bank isn't, you know, directly democratic in the sense of like, as far as I know, the plan is not to have, you know, elected boards. Maybe there is a few plans that are trying to go in that direction. The idea is to have like a charter and a board of directors that would help the bank operate a little bit more like a nonprofit acting in the public good, and that it would be accountable to people. And, you know, private banks, they only have to be accountable to shareholders. So I think that like with public banks, the idea is that like, it's written specifically in their charter that they do not have to be accountable to any shareholders. And I don't think, I don't know how shareholders would necessarily work with a public bank, but.
And there are examples of this, right? This isn't just like a pipe dream. This is something that's happening now. You've got the Bank of North Dakota, which I thought was a really good example.
Yeah. Yeah, there's not a lot of examples. So the Bank of North Dakota is the one state in the U.S. that has a public bank. So it's been really successful In a lot of ways, and in some ways there are aspects of it that's kind of a cautionary tale for like whether these banks would operate more ethically. I think that, you know, over the course of its existence, it's made tons of investments in like small farms and farmers and businesses to an extent that I don't think a private bank would have. However, it's also kind of invested in like fracking. I think they helped fund the like police response to the pipeline in North Dakota, Dakota Access Pipeline.
They lent them like that. They lent law enforcement $10 million.
Yeah. So in that sense, it's like, you know, the board of the Bank of North Dakota okayed those things. And for whatever reason, I don't know what the politics are like on the ground necessarily in North Dakota. Maybe a lot of their constituents and a lot of the folks or small businesses they lend to are fine with those investments. But I think the lesson is really like they're only going to act as ethically as their board and as their charter.
As their community does, right? Yeah,
as their community does.
It creates a banking system where the local community that's built around the bank the bank and its policies are more reflective of that local community, right? And which, you know, I might argue that perhaps that is also what happened to Silicon Valley Bank.
That's definitely an argument. Yeah. You could make that argument. I mean, I think I like to think the community in Silicon Valley and maybe the greater Bay Area is probably a little bit more complex and like the cross section of people who are relying on Silicon Valley Bank, but
that's fair.
Yeah, no, I'm sure. Yeah, that analogy definitely does make some sense.
All right, what are you working on? What else is in the pipe?
I have a story coming out Monday about, you know, you mentioned tenant unions, and I mentioned that in San Francisco they do have a law that forces landlords to negotiate with tenant unions. It's the only law in the country that makes it mandatory to negotiate with a tenant union. And it just went into effect last year. And I'm talking to a tenant union or a group of tenant unions who are saying that their giant corporate landlord, maybe unsurprisingly, does not really want to negotiate.
Shock. Like, big shock.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's what's on board for next week.
All right. Well, I look forward to reading that, and thank you so much for coming on to Cyber.
Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. If you like the show and you enjoyed listening to this, you can join us live and you can hear me doing the Windows notifications live and be punished by them in the instant and then yell at me online. Go to twitch.tv/motherboardtv or youtube.com/motherboard. Follow us there. You will be notified when we go live. Thank you so much to everybody in the chat. I know Linux is better. I just don't want to. I don't want to deal with it. I don't want to mess with it. Everybody, seeing some people asking for more UFO episodes. There's going to be more UFO episodes. We're going to bring Becky back. We're going to do like a science roundup of a bunch of her science reporting and do some more speculating about the lights in the sky. Real men use DOS. Yes, of course. These days, though, you really want to mess with the DOS window? Anyway. I'm getting caught up in chat. It's time to go. It's 3:30 on a Friday. Goodbye, everybody.
Bye, everybody.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more.
and is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.